This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, U.S. Marshals, the CIA, and being taken downtown. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode number 56 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. And this week, I'd like to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from deborahdunbar.com, CC Jameson from ccjameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of vickytharp.com, Dharma Kelleher of dharmakelleher.com, Chris Ann, Jimmy Coe of Crimibox, and Larry Darter for their support. I'd also like to thank all of my Coffee Club patrons for their support month after month. And you can find links to all of the writers supporting this episode by going to the show notes at writersdetective.com/56. And to learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business and to help me keep the lights on in the bureau, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. This week's first question comes from Ken Shoemaker, who you can find at facebook.com/ShoemakerKen51. Ken wrote, "Congratulations on the one-year anniversary for the podcast, and congratulations to all the winners. My question this week is, how often do you or other agencies use the U.S. Marshals Service to apprehend wanted fugitives? Do you or other detectives work with them in the hunt?" Yeah, Ken, I've worked with the U.S. Marshals deputies a few times on cases, and there are a variety of reasons why a local agency might work with the Marshals Service. In the most memorable case that I was involved in, the Marshals were helping a police department track a murder suspect who'd also been involved in a gunfight with the police. And the deputy U.S. Marshals were able to track the suspect's cell phone into my jurisdiction. So in this case, the Marshals Service was providing technical assistance in a state fugitive case. And that was a crazy night because I ended up on surveillance as the point person on the hotel room all night long. And then when our SWAT team was setting up on the hotel room, I somehow ended up being the one at the front desk calling all the rooms in that wing of the hotel as part of our SWAT team's evacuation plan. And then once that wing of the hotel was clear, I became the de facto hostage negotiator, talking to this murderer. I mean, this guy had his girlfriend in the room with him, and he's been drinking all night. And after being in a gunfight with the police, he confirms to me in one of my many phone calls into that room that he is in fact armed with several guns. And after a dozen or more phone calls, I somehow convinced him to surrender peacefully. And I'm not really clear on how or why the hostage negotiators were not called out on this incident. But I just relied on my skills of being able to talk to people, you know, rapport building and being honest, knowing that if I started bullshitting him, things would end badly for him and his girlfriend and everyone, really, which is why I'd rather be lucky than good any day. But anyway, the U.S. Marshals were the reason we were able to figure out where this guy was. I should go back and explain that the U.S. Marshals Service is a federal law enforcement agency within the United States Department of Justice, and it's actually the oldest federal law enforcement agency, dating back to 1789. They are the enforcement arm of the federal court system, which means everything from providing security in federal courthouses, kind of like a more robust version of bailiff duties for a municipal or superior court. But they also serve federal arrest warrants. They're responsible for transporting federal prisoners, a la Con Air. They run the Federal Witness Protection Program. And then, most notably, as Ken talked about, they hunt fugitives. Although their primary mandate is capturing federal fugitives, the U.S. Marshals Service assists state and local agencies in capturing their most violent fugitives as well. They have fugitive task forces all around the country that are run by the U.S. Marshals Service, but they will be staffed by both deputy U.S. Marshals and local police officers or sheriff's deputies or detectives working as one team. In the mid to late 2000s, the A&E network on television had a reality show called Manhunter's Fugitive Task Force, which did a great job of highlighting what it's like to work on a fugitive task force and just how dangerous it is to hunt down armed and dangerous fugitives. You might be able to find that show on demand somewhere. That was Manhunter's Fugitive Task Force, and it was on A&E, I think around 2008 or so. When I've worked cases where our suspects have fled and become fugitives, even when we were working with the FBI to get unlawful flight to avoid prosecution warrants, which are the federal warrants we need when we think our like murder or violent crime suspect has fled the country. But even though we were working with the FBI on that, the U.S. Marshals Service was always ready and willing to go out and find our bad guys. Being a deputy U.S. Marshal on a task force is definitely not a sit in a cubicle 9-to-5 kind of job. It can be exciting and dangerous work. So, Ken, those are the ways that I worked with the Marshals Service. And thanks again for your question. And you can find Ken's work on Facebook by going to facebook.com/ShoemakerKen51. Ann Bell Feinstein, who you can find on Twitter at Ann B. Feinstein, writes, "In my novel, a CIA agent is tasked to work with an FBI agent when it's been discovered that a chemical WMD has been smuggled across the border. The attack is just hours away. The CIA agent has information she gained overseas. Can she share this with the FBI? There won't be a trial if the bad guy dies. What, if any, restrictions would this duo have, given that all of the higher-ups are in on what's going on? This situation has already reached the Oval Office." Great questions, Anne. First, let me correct a tiny bit of terminology that is unique to the CIA. Now, you have two characters that are essentially equals, one working as a special agent for the FBI, and then the counterpart, the one working for the CIA, is an operations officer. In fact, all employees of the CIA are considered CIA officers, whether they are operations officers, which is in the clandestine service like your character would be, or intelligence analysts or technical officers, or, you know, there are many other job classes. But what I'm trying to correct here or point out is that in the CIA, an agent is an informant. They're also called human assets. Essentially, they're the ones doing the spying on behalf of the CIA. So a CIA agent is an informant. The FBI calls informants sources. So regardless of which agency we are talking about, if a CIA officer has an agent or a human asset, or an FBI special agent has a source, the existence of that informant in itself is classified. So you can't go talking about how you have an informant because it's classified. But both the CIA officer and the FBI special agent will both have top secret security clearances for sensitive, compartmented information, which is a mouthful to say, but they abbreviate it as TSSCI, which is written as the capital letters TS/SCI, and all of that's in capitals. And the SCI refers to the specific need-to-know information that that person has been vetted for. And I will link to a Washington Post article that covers the top five myths about security clearances. They'll be in the show notes at writersdetective.com/56. But that article does a great job of explaining the various sub-clearances associated with having a top secret security clearance. So anyway, your CIA officer and your FBI special agent will both have TSSCI clearances. So sharing that information between them would not be an issue. And furthermore, especially in the case of an imminent attack, threat information like that can be passed along to whomever needs to know, like a police chief or a county sheriff. The feds just can't divulge the source of the information to anyone without a clearance. But she can definitely say there is a credible chemical WMD threat that is imminent. What she can't say is, I have a source working in the Kremlin, or the NSA intercepted a phone call between so-and-so and so-and-so. If people are going to die, she best be focused on the end goal, and that is sharing that intelligence or sharing that information about a threat with the people that are charged with protecting the public. A lot of this was actually covered in the 9/11 Commission report, and I highly recommend reading that if you get a chance. As for restrictions, that's going to be kind of tricky. You see, the CIA's role as an intelligence agency is to collect that intelligence and information outside of the United States, whereas the FBI is the agency that collects intelligence and information within the United States. The FBI changed dramatically in the aftermath of 9/11, and one of the most notable changes was the scaling up of the intelligence side of things. So in most RAs are the resident agencies, which are the local FBI offices throughout the country. You'll have FBI special agents assigned to work criminal cases like bank robberies, serial killers, kidnappings, all the stuff you guys write about. And then there will also be FBI special agents assigned to work on the intel side, like international terrorism, domestic terrorism, counterintelligence, which is trying to catch other countries' spies doing spying in the United States. So an agent typically works on either the criminal side or the intel side. And the main reason that there is a divide between criminal and intel is that intel has classified material, like the overseas WMD intel that your character has, can't really be divulged as part of the discovery process in a criminal trial. There are certainly ways to redact aspects of it if it really needs to be presented at a trial for a critical criminal case. But as a general rule, classified material isn't supposed to be relied upon for criminal investigations. But that kind of intelligence is shared between the CIA and the FBI all the time. As for passing the intel up the chain on either the FBI or CIA side, that's not going to be an issue at all. That's what these agencies are set up to do. Be sure to research the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and then also the NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. Also, another post 9/11 change is the information sharing that happens at the local level. I mentioned the police chief and the county sheriff, but in today's world, it is very likely that the chief and the sheriff actually have secret security clearances. Probably not top secret, but secret, which means they can at least be briefed on classified investigations within their jurisdiction. And if they have any detectives within their agencies that are working as a task force officer on a joint terrorism task force, that detective will have a secret or even a top secret security clearance and may actually get pulled in to assist in the case. The FBI has made great strides in information sharing with the local cops in the years since 9/11. So to get back to your story, and your FBI special agent character is likely working IT on the intel side. And no, I'm not talking computers. IT in FBI speak is international terrorism. And they are the domestic counterpart to the CIA operations officer that has the overseas intel. Now, the minefield is going to be navigating what role the CIA is playing in a domestic mission. Since your story is focused on smuggling chemical WMDs across the border, it's the CIA's ball outside the wire and the FBI's ball inside the wire. A great story to see this CIA, FBI, international or domestic dynamic in action is the movie Sicario, which was written by Taylor Sheridan. So go pop some popcorn and sit down to watch it in the name of research. And if anyone asks, tell them I gave you this as CIA FBI homework. In this week's last question comes from Joan Raymond of joanraymondwritinganddesign.com. Joan writes, "This pertains to my work in progress. I'm still a bit confused on the difference between being taken down to the police station to be questioned and being arrested. If the police show up at your door and say they are taking you in for questioning regarding a murder, do you have to go? Can you ask if you're under arrest? And if they say no, can you refuse to go? Or is it better to comply? If you're not under arrest and you go with them, can you leave at any time? Thanks, Adam. These are great questions, Joan. If the detective asks you to come to the station for an interview, the suspect's doing so consensually or voluntarily. If the detective tells you, you're coming with me, and you object, then that detective needs to have probable cause to take you into custody, which is the same standard as making an arrest. Now, whether you're actually under arrest at that point can be debated, but from a legal standpoint, you're either free and you can refuse to go to the station, or the detective or that officer has probable cause to arrest you and can legally take you to the station, and you're considered in custody. So you still have your right to not answer any questions and have a lawyer present. And assuming you're not free to leave and the detective wants to talk to you about that murder, you're going to have your rights read to you. So to be clear and answer your specific questions in order, Joan, if the police show up at your door and say they are taking you in for questioning regarding a murder, do you have to go? You can ask if you're under arrest. If they say no, but you have to come with me, you can ask, am I free to leave? If they say no, you are, from a legal standpoint, under arrest, or at least being detained, which means the police have sufficient probable cause to arrest you. Even if they have PC, they may decide not to arrest you once the interview is over, because there's a big difference between having enough probable cause to arrest you and having enough evidence to prove that you're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. If you're not under arrest and you go with them voluntarily, yes, you can leave at any time. The detectives will usually explain to you that you're free to end the interview at any time, you're free to leave at any time, and that you're not locked in the interview room. You are physically free to leave. Like, you can push the door open and walk out of the building. These statements will likely be recorded as well, because it's proof that this is not a custodial interrogation, which means they don't have to advise you of your rights, because the requirement for reading the Miranda admonishment only applies to custodial interrogations. And if you're free to leave and the door's unlocked, this is not custodial. Now, it's certainly possible that at some point during the interview or interrogation that you become no longer free to leave. Say the person is there voluntarily and they know they can leave at any time, the door's unlocked, and during the interview, the person says, I killed her. At that point, any reasonable person would believe that the interviewee is no longer free to leave because they just admitted to murder, or at least some sort of homicide. So before another question is asked, the detective would most likely read the Miranda admonishment to that person before going any further. So it might go something like this: and that's why I killed her. Okay, I understand. And I have more questions about that, and I really want to hear the rest of your story. But before that happens, I need to read something to you, okay? You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to have an attorney present before and during any questioning if you wish one. And if you cannot afford to hire an attorney, one will be provided for you. Do you understand the rights I've just read to you? Yes? Having these rights in mind, do you want to keep talking to me? Yeah, so as I was saying, I killed her because... Or they say no, and they don't want to keep talking to you, and that's the end of the interview. Now, some prosecutors are cool with what's called implied consent, meaning the detective doesn't ask that second question about whether they're willing to talk with me. And it would go like, and if you cannot afford to hire an attorney, one will be provided for you. Do you understand the rights I've just read to you? Yes. Okay, so now that you've been honest about killing her, why did you do it? Well, she blah, 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 blah. The fact that our suspect has been read his rights, said he understood, and then continued talking to me after being asked another question implies that he wants to keep talking. Many prosecutors' offices do not want to have to argue implied consent. And they want their Miranda admonishments to be clear-cut affirmative responses to both understanding their rights and waiving them. So you really need to know what your prosecutor will or won't take on when it comes to arguing this point in court. Because if a defense attorney gets a hold of the implied consent issue because they did not get an affirmative waiver to their right, you know, to be free from self-incrimination, you're definitely going to be spending time on the stand. But that's one of the things you're weighing as a detective, is whether or not just going the implied consent route may lead to further admissions or a confession. But the bottom line, Joan, is that you're either free or you're not. If you aren't free, it means they have the same amount of probable cause needed to arrest you. Now, there is one exception to this when it comes to being free to leave, and that's when you're being briefly detained out in public. Not being taken to the station for questioning, but when the police officer has detained you to briefly investigate further whether a crime is occurring or just occurred. So let's say there have been a bunch of car burglaries in a specific neighborhood, and I'm in that neighborhood at 3:30 in the morning, and I spot a guy in all dark clothing peeking into cars and carrying a dark backpack. I don't have probable cause to arrest this guy, much less take him downtown to be questioned about car burglaries. But I certainly have reasonable suspicion to think that he's up to casing cars and may have burglary tools in his backpack. So those are still articulable facts, much like probable cause. I just don't have as much. I know I've talked in the past about the wine glass analogy of as you put more facts into that cup, it gets higher and higher, and you go from reasonable cause to probable cause to, you know, when it's completely tippy top full, that's your beyond a reasonable doubt. So the courts have held in the case Terry v. Ohio that I can briefly detain this person to investigate further if he's involved in breaking into those cars. So I could pat him down to make sure he didn't have any weapons on him, and I could perhaps have my partner stay with him while I check the other cars on the block to see if they were broken into. And I realize this doesn't really fall into your murder investigation scenario, but it's important to understand the reasonable suspicion standard, which, while not as significant as probable cause, it does still allow for brief detentions out in the field. Oh, and the old don't leave town line that the cops may use on your murder suspect, that holds no legal recourse. You are either free or you aren't. And as long as the guy isn't on probation, parole, or out on bail, where some of your rights have been abridged in exchange for being let out of jail early, then you're free like any other member of the public to go anywhere you please. So if a cop says don't leave town, they're just trying to make it easy on themselves for finding you later. So I hope this helps clarify that, Joan. And again, you can find Joan's work at joanraymondwritinganddesign.com. Hey, real quick, is your work in progress a giant Word or Google Doc that is totally unmanageable, that might be saved in a folder with pictures and notes and references all jumbled in? Why not use a word processor, an outliner designed for bringing all those things together and making those big documents, like an entire novel, way more manageable, allowing you to focus on smaller sections at a time and in any order? That's exactly what Scrivener is designed for. Scrivener is available for Mac, Windows, and even iOS for those of you writing on the go on iPads or iPhones. To get a free 30-day trial of Scrivener, and that's 30 days of actual writing where you open Scrivener, not 30 days on a calendar, go to writersdetectivebureau.com/Scrivener and check it out for yourself. That's writersdetectivebureau.com/Scrivener. Thank you so much for listening this week. Make sure you hit that subscribe button to get every episode of the Writers Detective Bureau podcast automatically. If you enjoyed this episode, I would love it if you'd leave me a review. Please don't let me run out of questions again. Send me your crime fiction questions by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.